Hello, John Dennis here on Friday the 1st of May. Today, as swine flu spreads, Mexico's economy shuts down.
What's gone from now being a semi-ghost town to almost a total ghost town, there's a remarkable stillness about it.
Also today, MPs vote to reform their expenses. Not a good week for Gordon Brown, though.
I think for Gordon Brown it's become a status issue.
And computer skills are at the centre of a shake-up of the national curriculum for primary schools.
We see quite a lot of what Sir Jim has recommended as being good primary practice.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
First, Bill Overton with the headlines and the papers.
Health officials fear they may be dealing with the first case of someone catching swine flu in Britain. A man who knows the Scottish couple who caught it in Mexico is suspected of also being ill from the virus. He's being treated at home with Tamiflu while further tests are being analysed. Normal life in Mexico is being shut down as far as possible for 5 days. The idea is to slow the spread of swine flu. All non-essential government offices are closed, along with businesses like cinemas and restaurants. The country's health chief says the spread of the virus has already slowed. There are 300 confirmed cases in Mexico, with more than 160 deaths suspected to have been caused by the disease. The third biggest car company in the US, Chrysler, is bankrupt, but it doesn't mean it'll close down. There's a deal to merge with the Italian manufacturer Fiat on the table, but some of Chrysler's creditors won't agree to it. It would mean they'd get only a third of their money back, so it's now up to the bankruptcy court to settle the matter. The government's lent Chrysler $4 billion, which it doesn't expect to get back. But President Obama says he supports the deal with Fiat and blames city speculators for holding it up. The Treasury Committee of MPs says the banking crisis was largely the fault of reckless bankers. The committee agrees the government took the right action to save the banking system, but they report banks are still making it difficult for businesses to borrow money. The MPs argue that banks should be split, ordinary high street banks separated from the risky investment side of the business. Meanwhile, The Guardian's discovered the government's big scheme to stop people being thrown out of their homes by the mortgage crisis has had very little effect. The mortgage protection scheme was expected to cost nearly £300 million and help 6,000 families, but in fact only one family has actually benefited. That's one of the stories on The Guardian's front page this morning, but it leads with a political warning to Gordon Brown from a former cabinet minister, David Blunkett. He says there's been a catastrophic meltdown of trust in the government. The Telegraph goes further with its headline, "Brown's lost it," say ministers. After losing one vote over the Gurkhas this week and a U-turn on MPs' expenses, one cabinet minister tells the paper Gordon's looking for someone to blame, and another that Gordon isn't listening. They predict a Labour loss at the next election as big as John Major's to Tony Blair. The latest swine flu victim, who may have caught the disease from the Scottish couple who came back from honeymoon in Mexico, is reported in The Guardian and The Mail. The Mail says that he's an NHS worker who went on a night out with the couple. The Guardian says the Scots complained of a group of men coughing and sneezing on their plane home. The Telegraph and Financial Times both make space for car company Chrysler on their front pages. The FT says the US president blames the hedge fund dealers for forcing the businesses to get protection from the bankruptcy court. The Telegraph says Fiat will show Chrysler how to build smaller, more efficient cars. The Times carries a picture of the Dutch royal couple, Crown Prince Willem-Alexander and his wife, with hands over their mouths in horror when a car crashed into a crowd, watching them killing five people. This morning's Express shouts at us, "Hooray, sizzling summer on way!" And The Sun is proud to show us a picture of the rompers in royal rumpus, the couple who had sex on the Queen's front lawn. There's more news, sport, throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
With the swine flu pandemic now imminent, according to the World Health Organization, Britain's Department of Health has begun its information campaign.
Flu viruses can spread if you don't catch your coughs or sneezes hygienically, passing flu from person to person. Flu viruses can live on hard surfaces for several hours, making flu easy to spread. To prevent the spread of flu when you cough or sneeze, catch it in a clean tissue, bin it, and kill it by washing your hands as soon as you can. Catch it, bin it, kill it. Call 0800 1513 513 to hear the latest information on swine flu.
Countries are responding in different ways to the risk of swine flu. The United Nations said Egypt was making a big mistake by beginning a mass cull of up to 400,000 pigs. The UN says the virus hasn't been found in pigs. In Luxembourg, European health ministers held emergency talks aimed at coordinating their response. The United States has now reported 91 cases of swine flu across 10 states. The Vice President Joe Biden advised Americans to avoid underground trains and air travel to reduce their chance of catching swine flu.
I would tell members of my family, and I have, I wouldn't go anywhere in confined places now. It's not that it's going to Mexico, it's you're in a confined aircraft. When one person sneezes, it goes all the way through the aircraft. That's me. I would not be at this point, if they had another way of transportation, suggesting they ride the subway. So from my perspective, what it relates to is mitigation. If you're out in the middle of a field and someone sneezes, that's one thing. If you're in a closed aircraft, a closed container, a closed car, a closed classroom, it's a different thing.
In Mexico, from where the virus originated, President Felipe Calderon advised people to stay at home. He wants a five-day partial shutdown of the economy. The Guardian's Rory Carroll reports from the streets of Mexico City.
The Mexican government has advised people to not go to work unless their jobs involve essential services, and to stay at home with their families and to hunker down for 5 days. So basically it's a nationwide lockdown.
Are Mexicans heeding the call to stay at home?
Yes, well, the nation has already been in kind of in slow motion lockdown for the past week or so. I mean, schools, cinemas have been shutting down. Most restaurants have closed. Most businesses have shut even before this latest edict. So what's gone from now being a semi-ghost town to almost a total ghost town. There's a remarkable stillness about it, especially, which is all the more amazing given that Mexico City is a huge conglomeration of 20 million people. And to have this turning into a ghost town now is just extraordinary.
This swine flu outbreak has really hit the already struggling Mexican economy.
Yes, I mean, the economy was hurting already from a recession. It actually contracted by up to maybe 8% in the last couple of months. But now it's going from hurting to screaming. I mean, it's really, really tough for Mexicans because economic activity has almost come to a standstill. The tourism sector, for instance, has simply evaporated. And people, just if they can't go to work, there's just no productivity left in the economy. So there's some very grim warnings about what the economic impact is going to be at the end of all of this.
Rory Carroll, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/swineflu. Also on The Guardian's website, today it's 5 years since 8 new countries were admitted into the European Union. Michael Keith from Oxford University, who's behind a major research project on migration, asks what lessons have been learned from that. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. Mulatu Astatke invented Ethiopian jazz. Now he's reinventing himself. Find out about him at guardian.co.uk/music. And our film critic Peter Bradshaw reviews a new British film called Helen. He says that first-time writer-directors Christine Molloy and Joe Lawler are real talents with a distinctive filmmaking language of their own. guardian.co.uk/film. After a series of scandals, last week Gordon Brown set out his proposals on reforming MPs' expenses in a video on the Number 10 website. Well, the Commons voted last night on a series of reforms. I spoke to Andrew Sparrow in our Westminster office shortly after the vote.
Well, they voted on quite a substantial package of reforms, really. If you'd told anyone 3 months ago that they'd vote to declare full details of all their outside jobs, kind of how much they earn for their directorships, how many hours they earn, if they'd voted to pay all receipts, if they'd voted to clamp down on the money that London MPs can earn, and if they'd voted to change the way they employ their staff in the House of Commons, people would have been surprised by that. So there are quite a substantial number of changes, but what they haven't done is address the thing that is at the core of all the unhappiness and controversy about their expenses, which is this additional cost allowance, as it's called, or the second home allowance, the £24,000 a year they can get for their second homes and bath plugs and kitchens and all the rest of it. On that, they've basically shelved it until the Committee on Standards and Public Life comes out with a plan.
Why didn't they just allow the committee to decide on everything else?
Well, I think for Gordon Brown it's become a status issue. He made this kind of bold YouTube announcement last week when he said, look, we've got to deal with it now. And his plans started to unravel pretty quickly. And there was a, the the thrust of the debate, it was a long and at times quite passionate debate, and where they were kind of dealing with all sorts of issues. But the key dividing line in the House was between those MPs who were saying, look, that we've this outside body, it's started an inquiry, it's daft to try and preempt it, and others who said, well, let's come up with interim proposals. It was difficult for the government and for Labour, with the Prime Minister having sort of nailed his colours to the mask on getting quick reform, to then turn around and say, well, actually, we made a bit of a mistake, it would make more sense to put it off. So there would have been a huge loss of face for Gordon Brown if he had simply said, let's shelve all this and wait and see what the committee comes up with.
So all in all, not a great week for Gordon Brown.
It hasn't been a great week, and the Gurkhas was probably a much more significant defeat than this one, because that showed him sort of clearly on the wrong side of public opinion. He kind of lost a big vote in the House of Commons. He's going to have to come up with alternative plans, which he was telling us in the House of Commons yesterday could cost over £1 billion or so. This he will be able to say, well, look, I've nudged the debate on a bit, I've made some progress, which is true, but he wanted to be able to bury the MP's expenses issue as a great sleaze controversy which was damaging in the government before July, when these 4 million odd expenses get published. What he's done today hasn't buried that issue, so it's not a great day for him.
Andrew Sparrow. My name's John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come, black people are being targeted by the police, whose use of anti-terror stop and search powers trebled last year. And Sir Michael Caine on acting.
My idea of bad movie acting is you're sitting there and you say, isn't that Michael Caine a wonderful actor? Look at him. He's a fantastic actor. That's crap.
But first, computer skills are to become as important as reading and writing in primary schools. Sir Jim Rose, who was asked by the government to review the primary curriculum, says that ICT, information and communication technology, should be made a core skill. And teachers should get extra training so that they can stay ahead of computer-savvy pupils. Ministers are expected to accept Sir Jim's recommendations, but what do teachers think? Mick Brooks is General Secretary of the National Association of Head Teachers.
Broadly, we welcome his recommendation. We particularly recommend or appreciate his talking about primary education as being exemplars of good practice. And we see quite a lot of what Sir Jim has recommended as being good primary practice. But in particular, the emphasis on ICT is important. So he does make sure that the review of the curriculum moves into the 21st century in the way to the 19th. And making sure that teachers actually catch up to some of their children, I think, is very important, because children just take to IT and the digital revolution. It's been part of their lives. It's not been part of some of ours.
I mean, to be clear, this isn't a choice between learning about the Victorians and how to use Twitter.
No, well, any curriculum is going to offer children choice, and that's absolutely right. So it's not either or. It's both, and it's not about learning. It's actually acknowledging the fact that communication these days is totally different to the days when some of us were at school. And I think the acknowledgement that we're in the 21st century is good. I think some people have grossly distorted what Sir Jim has been saying, and it simply is just acknowledging that young people will communicate in lots of different ways, some of which are quite alien to some of us.
Just one other issue I'd like to ask you about, if I may, Mr. Brooks. On Saturday, the National Association of Head Teachers votes on boycotting SAT tests. What do you hope a boycott will achieve?
Well, let's just be absolutely clear about this. The motion that we're going to be voting on, at the end of it says, once we have turned over every stone, once we've pursued every avenue to persuade the government to move away from the current system, which I think practically everybody acknowledges is not good for children, and it damages and narrows their education, it's only unless, so only if, we're not able to get anywhere, so that we then are faced with a very difficult choice. And it is a moral dilemma. Do we allow this this assessment system to continue, and or do we actually stand up and take action?
Mick Brooks. A quick mention that you can follow the doings of the Guardian Daily podcast at twitter.com/Guardian Daily. As political parties look at drastic action to contain public spending, the future of the Trident nuclear deterrent is in doubt. A strong nuclear deterrent has long been an article of faith for the Conservatives. Up until now, the Tories have supported Labour's plans to upgrade Trident, which would cost £21 billion over the next 20 years. But the party leader David Cameron says an incoming Tory government would review defence spending commitments. Our security editor, Richard Norton Taylor, explains how scrapping Trident would affect Britain's defences.
People say that it basically, today, it has no strategic relevance at all. It was argued during the Cold War that it could, you know, be useful maybe to cause uncertainty. Uncertainty was a great sort of deterrence principle in Moscow about whether, you know, another country in the West would actually use nuclear weapons separate from the US and maybe hit particular military targets. Now, of course, the Cold War is no longer with us, but the government here, the British government, says that, we could face a similar threat sometime in the future. The world's an uncertain place and so on. Therefore, we must replace our Trident system with a new submarine, a nuclear missile submarine fleet.
And we hear this expression, it gets us a seat at the top table.
Well, that's what a lot of people say. That's its only main use anyway, politically. You know, we were at a lot of different top tables. Every single member of the permanent five UN on the UN Security Council have nuclear weapons. They're members of the official nuclear weapon club. But more and more people also say that even that's getting increasingly relevant because the economic power and other kind of power that's important, India, for example, Brazil, Japan, they'll probably be permanent members of the UN Security Council. They are not, well, India is actually, but Japan certainly is not, nor is Brazil, South Africa have given up nuclear weapons actually. So, you know, that argument is dilute or even is no longer relevant either. And especially the other point they say, the critics of Trident say that the enemies now, you know, are insurgents or terrorists or Al-Qaeda people or cyber warfare and so on, and you can't use Trident against any of that.
What are the alternatives to Trident?
There's no nuclear missile system. There's no nuclear weapon system, which is really sort of alternative, because the only credible, if you like, if you're going to have a nuclear weapon system at all, it's got to be hidden, it's got to be on a submarine. Now, that's the conventional argument. That's the main argument that people use, of course. Other people say you cannot which is also, I think, true, you cannot disinvent nuclear weapons and nuclear technology. Therefore, those countries who really want to, who have had nuclear technology, you keep them in reserve. You have a few bombs, if you like, and you can, it takes only about 6 months. The Japanese have said that too. You know, it takes a few months to actually gear yourself up to having a nuclear weapon if there's such a crisis or the world is in such a state that you actually think you need one. You have the technology, you have the art, but not the article, as Churchill said a long time ago.
Richard Norton Taylor. The police stopped and searched three times as many people last year as in the previous 12 months. New Justice Department figures show that black people were targeted disproportionately. Alan Travis is our Home Affairs editor. He's got the details.
They show that in the aftermath of the failed London bomb attacks in the Haymarket in 2007, the police, particularly the Metropolitan Police, increased sharply their use of what's known as Section 44, stop and search powers under the counter-terrorism laws. Between 2006, 2007 and 2007, 2008, they rose from 37,000 people stopped and searched under these powers to 117,000. And that massive surge and use in them was disproportionately targeted at black people and at Asian people, with a number of black people being stopped and searched under these powers rising by an astonishing 322%. A number of Asian people increasing by 277%.
And there have been suggestions from civil liberties campaigners that these anti-terrorism powers are being used for purposes other than that for which they were intended.
That's right, yes. The Metropolitan Police say that the Justice Ministry, who published these figures, say that the large rise in street searches reflect the robust response by the Metropolitan Police to the threat of terror-related networks in London since the Haymarket bomb. However, both Liberty, in the shape of Karina Ferguson, one of their barristers, and also, I have to say, the Shadow Home Secretary, Chris Grayling, say that they think that such a huge exponential increase in the use of the powers must be unrelated to terrorism arrests. Liberty point out that only 6 in 10,000 people stopped and searched under these powers have actually been arrested for terror offences.
And what effect does this surge in stop and search powers have on the police relationship with the public?
Well, overall, this big increase in these Cantera powers has increased their use of stop and search generally, PACE as it's called, mainly for drugs, to more than a million stop and searches across England and Wales for the year 2007-2008, with again black people being eight times more likely to be stopped than white people. This is actually an increase in the last two or three years over the disproportionality that black people face when being on the streets, particularly young black men. And that, I think, is aggravating and increasing the amount of tension on the streets.
Alan Travis. So Michael Caine is one of the greatest British screen stars. In his latest role, he plays an elderly magician with Alzheimer's. That's in the film Is Anybody There? He told The Guardian's Zan Brooks what he's trying to achieve as an actor.
It was a very difficult part to do. And in my own estimation, I got it right. Sometimes you'll make a movie and you'll see it and say, oh, I wish I'd have done that. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have done this and we should have done that. And I sat there and there was none of that. I just thought, that's Clarence, that's it. My idea of bad movie acting is you're sitting there and you say, isn't that Michael Caine a wonderful actor? Look at him, he's a fantastic actor. That's crap. You've got to be sitting there saying, I wonder what's going to happen to Clarence now. You should be worried about Clarence, not me. And I always try to make, first of all, me disappear, the ego disappear, then the acting disappear. And then you just see the person. And that's what I think I did in this picture. You just see Clarence.
Are you a magician?
No. I'm a retired flasher.
This used to be my room until Arnold came.
Who's he when he's at home?
He's not anybody now. He's dead. He died in that bed. If you see anything supernatural, do you think you can inform me?
Do you think you can bagger off?
The role of Clarence had a personal element for you too, in that you'd observed the experiences of Alzheimer's sort of firsthand.
Yeah. One of my best friends, Dougie Hayward, my tailor, was dying during that film. Let me hasten to add, this movie isn't about Alzheimer's or dementia, but I had very close-up and personal experience of it for several years, so I knew what it was like, and it was rather unsettling to do it, but I had to do it.
You live on your own all your life, and then they think it's a great idea to shove you together with a load of strangers. Look at them, as if they died years ago, and no one was good enough to tell them. Why aren't they screaming?
I've always had a life outside of show business, which has been more important than show business. I feel that movies retire you and not the other way around, you know, and I figure I will be sitting waiting for a part and a part won't come and then I'll be gone, but my life is going on in other areas.
What did you do that for?
Oh, I'm pissing against the wind. I'm drenching my Macintosh. You don't come back, son. Once they've gone, you can't talk to them.
He'd still like to come back as a badger. Do you have any particular preference?
No, well, I wouldn't mind coming back, but not as a badger. I myself would come back as me. I had a great time. I wouldn't change a thing.
Michael Caine talking to Zan Brooks. Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.